Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the IJK podcast. Today I'm joined by one of the most influential voices in Bitcoin education, Natalie Brunel. Natalie is the host of Coin Stories, the number one Bitcoin podcast in the world. Through her remarkable storytelling and deep insights, she bridges technology, finance, and the human spirit, reaching millions of listeners worldwide. Featuring eminent guests like Michael Saylor, Anthony Pompliano, and Jack Mallers, the show has earned its place among the top business podcasts in the US. This fall, Natalie is releasing her first book, Bitcoin is for Everyone, an accessible guide to understanding money, our financial system, and how Bitcoin can empower individuals. Before entering the Bitcoin space, Natalie was an award-winning investigative journalist and professor of storytelling at USC. Natalie, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to speaking with you.
Thanks. Natalie, before we dive into Bitcoin and your work today, I would love to start with your personal story first. So you've had such a fascinating journey. I know you were born in Poland and then moved to the US when you were five. Then you grew up there and became a successful journalist. So how did this experience, or let's call it this origin story, shape the way you think about opportunity in business or in life in general?
Sure. So I feel like I had many seeds planted at an early age to really appreciate Bitcoin, even though I really knew nothing about the financial system when I was growing up, except for I would hear stories about how difficult it was to be raised under communism by my parents who, you know, wanted to flee Poland. They wanted to go to the United States in pursuit of the American dream because the sense of economic mobility was really not possible in Poland at the time. So they dreamt of coming here. They waited a very, very long time. And I was lucky enough to be 5 years old when we came. So I assimilated very quickly. But I saw how different the lifestyle was for my friends, my American friends, than my parents who were working multiple jobs. Things were really tough. You know, they were trying to start over from scratch. And then just as they were finally able to achieve a modest version of the American dream and purchase their first townhome outside of Chicago, the great financial crisis happened. This was while I was in college, and then they lost everything. So I actually entered into my career as a journalist with this feeling that the system is broken. There's a sense of injustice because the average person, the average American who had worked so hard over the last decade or two, they were not bailed out, but the banks that had taken on all this risk and created these asset bubbles, they were bailed out by the taxpayers. And so I felt like that was really unfair, but I didn't know where to channel my frustration. So I kind of channeled it into work. I really wanted to stand up for the average person and lift up those voices and have them be heard through journalism. But it wasn't till I learned about Bitcoin in 2017 that I finally connected the dots to the money. I feel like before that, I did what so many people even today do, which is I got lost in the fog of politics and I thought maybe one party or another could fix it. And I didn't realize that the system actually itself, the money itself needs to be fixed if we're going to address some of the most pressing issues facing society. And so that's where I started to find a lot of hope in Bitcoin, because as a young person who has also experienced what it's like to go into debt with college tuition and not being able to secure work that really helps you secure things like having a home, I really felt like we were all left behind. And Bitcoin allows us to catch up and it allows for a more level playing field so that we don't feel so disenfranchised by the system that keeps ballooning wealth concentration more and more at the expense of the average worker. So I know there was a lot there in that answer, but I really did find a lot of hope in Bitcoin that it can empower the individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for sharing. You spent many years in traditional media before going independent. So what made you decide it was time to make a move?
It was kind of accidental. So I was a reporter and I actually really loved my job. I loved doing interviews and conducting investigations and holding people accountable. So I actually really loved being a journalist, but I wasn't able to explore my new interest in Bitcoin. I was so curious about it. I was curious about the people who I was learning from, and I was only able to do a few Bitcoin stories here and there. So I decided to do my podcast really as a hobby. I just wanted to continue learning about Bitcoin, and I decided to use my skills of communication and journalism to bring, you know, bring those worlds together. What I didn't know is that it would naturally find an audience. I feel like there weren't very many shows out there by sort of mainstream voices and communicators. A lot of the shows maybe were done more by and for people that were more technical or had a finance background or an engineering or computer science background, whereas I was really just trying to speak to the average person and hear also more of the human interest stories behind Bitcoin and Bitcoin's thought leaders. So the podcast sort of took off and I was confronted with a decision. Should I stay in my stable 9-to-5 job that I had grown to, you know, it grew to feel very comfortable. I knew what to expect within the news industry, or should I venture off on my own and become an entrepreneur where there are no guarantees? But I'm really grateful that I did it because I just felt called to the opportunity to educate people in Bitcoin. I felt like there are so many people out there that would benefit from the knowledge. And I thought that if I dedicated my time growing the podcast, that eventually the money would come. And so that was 4 years ago, and I'm really grateful that I took a chance on myself.
Wow, way to go. Already 4 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you've mentioned before that Bitcoin is more than just a technology, it's a philosophy. So what do you exactly mean by that?
Well, Bitcoin, it's so interesting that it intersects with every single school of thought and industry and skill set. I just was fascinated by the fact that really Bitcoin connects with everything because money connects to everything, right? I mean, it's how we interact, even if we don't think about it. Everything that is in your room, wherever you are right now, someone built it, someone created it, someone produced it and had to measure things like the cost of things versus, you know, how much they could get for them. I mean, money really touches everything. It's sort of the blood of an economy. And none of us really learn about what's wrong with our money. What's wrong with the fact that someone can just click a button and expand the supply? How does that impact all of our purchasing power and how we really see and communicate value? And so Bitcoin is what really helped me to connect those dots, because I never appreciated that we don't have to live in a in an economy and in a society where things just get more expensive every year and we accept it, right? Because that's what most people do, is we think, well, it was cheaper for, you know, our grandparents to purchase something than it is today, and it'll be more expensive for future generations. But we never stop to ask, why is that? And is that the only way that we can sort of orient an economy? And it's not. That's what I kind of learned with Bitcoin. Inflation is something that is not natural. It's man-made. and we don't have to accept it. I think that that's what's so exciting about Bitcoin, is it causes you to question some of the things that you never did before, in a way that, again, kind of empowers the average individual, not just with the ability to save for the future, but also with knowledge that helps us connect to one another more. Because once you start learning about history or look back at history from the frame and the point of view of how money works and how money has evolved throughout different empires and generations, you start to appreciate that certain decisions were made because of who would benefit financially, right? And so I think it's important to look at it from that framing, to appreciate what's happened in history, and so that we don't repeat some of the same mistakes, which we have been for a very long time. And that's why I find, again, so much hope in Bitcoin, because it allows us to actually rewrite the future. We've never had a perfectly engineered money before that is inflation proof. I would say that gold is the next best form of hard money, but it does have inflation, right? Because you can always mine Bitcoin if there's a growing demand for it. And it also doesn't settle quickly. So now we have this perfect form of money that settles instantly globally, and literally will eventually have no inflation once we mine the last Bitcoin. So it makes me really excited to teach people about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned gold. I mean, I know for a fact that in the 70s, the US dollars was decoupled from gold and it had a life of its own. And then that's where inflation started to get worse and worse year after year. So yeah, there you go. By the way, coming from a journalism background, what frustrates you most about how mainstream media tend to cover Bitcoin or economics in general?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's just not given enough attention. And when it is, they fall into the temptation to cover only the negative headlines or the negative things that they've heard, whether or not they're true. And so that is really frustrating because I don't see any tool and any technology that empowers more people, regardless of what their background is, regardless of what their skills are, regardless of what their politics are. It's a truly uplifting technology, and it's something that people around the world need so badly. When the average person today, I'll just speak about our country in general first, America, we have what you used to be able to afford with one income, now it takes three. We have more and more young people who see no hope in the future, people who aren't having families because of the cost of everything, people who are burdened with hundreds of thousands of dollars in college tuition debt. So I just feel like there's so much that the average person could benefit from when it comes to adopting Bitcoin, because we've been so disempowered by the current financial system. And I just feel like the media could do more, really, to focus on the uplifting stories about Bitcoin globally, especially as a tool for human rights, as a tool for financial freedom. It's also been doing tremendous things for corporations. I think eventually sovereign nations will adopt it in their treasuries as well, in their reserves. So there's so much there to cover, and largely it's been ignored or not taken seriously. That's one of the reasons why I also went out on my own, because that needed to change.
Yeah, I see. Currently, I live in Canada, and trust me, we have it even worse here when it comes to high prices, unaffordable housing. It's a disaster here. So, today you're one of the most recognizable voices helping people understand Bitcoin through your podcast, Coin Stories, which I mentioned at the beginning. I feel it's approachable and well-researched. And I think it's really rare in this space because there's lots of misinformation as well. So what was your vision when you started Coin Stories?
Well, at the beginning, again, it was just a hobby while I was a full-time reporter. So for me, what I really wanted Coin Stories to be was to give a behind-the-scenes look at the people who were the biggest thought leaders in Bitcoin. So I was studying and learning from, very prominent names and people who came from all different backgrounds and expertise, like Saifedean Ammous, who's an economist, and Michael Saylor, who was a tech CEO for decades, and Lynn Alden, who comes from an electrical engineering and investing background. I mean, so many just fascinating, diverse people. And I just wanted to better understand who they were, where they came from, and why they came to the conviction that Bitcoin solves so many of these problems and why they're invested in it. So it was going to be a short-lived series. I thought I was going to do maybe 12 episodes and that was it, because there were about a dozen or so names who I really wanted to interview. And what I didn't expect is that it took off and people kept requesting other guests. And there were so many people that were developing, their backgrounds and their names in the space. And I wanted to interview them as well. And so it just kind of kept going and kept rolling. And so now I combine the show, which is also interviews. I still do, sit down and one-on-one interviews, but I also do a weekly news update, just 10 minutes long. It's the same time it takes to mine a Bitcoin block. It's called the News Block. And you can subscribe to the free newsletter at thenewsblock.substack.com. But I just wanted to give people updates on the developments that were happening, not just in Bitcoin, but in the economy and geopolitics, in an approachable, digestible way. 10 minutes, I think anyone can listen to that. So that's been fun as well, because that taps into my news background as well. So the next step for me is really just to focus back on 101, like the fundamentals, because sometimes we forget that we were all new, right? And we didn't all know the jargon and the vocabulary. And now that we're deep down the rabbit hole, I just want us to still take a step back and be able to have conversations with people that are very new, and teach them about Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining and the financial system, which is why I really wanted to write the book. And that will be accompanied by a lot of 101 video content over the next year.
Oh, sounds exciting. I always find your content very useful and very approachable. So even for non-technical people or people who are not necessarily familiar with the whole jargon that you just mentioned, you know, you still manage to simplify complex ideas and make them really, really approachable. So thank you for that. Has there been a guest or an episode that completely shifted your own perspective on money or Bitcoin? Within your coin series, your coin story.
I really can't name just one. So many of them. I'll never forget some of the first times that I interviewed Jeff Booth or Lynn Alden, because it's one thing to read their tweets and to read their books or their research papers. But when you have them in conversation, especially if you can do it in person, it really is transformative. Jeff Booth just has such a thoughtful way of guiding you through this massive transition that is underway. And a lot of people, I think, get scared by transitions, right? They're scared of forces that are deflationary, like AI, and they are worried that the state will ultimately retain control because it kind of always has. And Jeff Booth has this very positive Zen-like way of saying that, no, we actually decide the future and we're all making that decision by opting out and investing in Bitcoin. And it could actually be a very beautiful one full of abundance. So I really appreciate that about him. Lynn is just so patient because her mind works like no one I've ever encountered. I mean, she is just light years ahead of us. And it's so fascinating to hear her step back and sort of just explain things. Like her book, Broken Money, is so approachable. Like it's very long, but so approachable, explaining the entire financial system so thoroughly, so thoughtfully, with no bias, with no drama, you know, no need to
fluff.
Sometimes you read and people are they're so extreme and they're trying to get your attention and clicks. And Lynn is just always just even keel down the middle. And then of course, Michael Saylor. I think few people are as brilliant and as pioneering as someone like him, who has so much experience running a public company. He's always just cheerful, constructive. You never hear him say a single negative thing about anyone. He just believes in Bitcoin and has dedicated his life to it. It is a part of his purpose now. These financial products that he's engineering are so innovative. And I just find him to be so fascinating as well, especially because his background is so impressive. And now he's literally dedicated his life and his career to Bitcoin and Bitcoin education. So yeah, I mean, there's not one person, there's just so many. And I recently had Maurizio Di Bartolomeo on the show. He shared his whole backstory about coming from Venezuela, where his family literally escaped with just Bitcoin, because that's how Bitcoin works. You can go anywhere with it. You can flee an oppressive regime, and how he built up his company. And so everyone has a story, right? Like that's one of my favorite parts about the podcast. Everyone has a story. You just have to find it. And I'm very grateful for the guests that have been on the show.
Yeah, for sure. We've talked about the philosophy behind Bitcoin, but let's look ahead a bit. There's a lot of discussion about the future of Bitcoin. So some people wonder whether it will truly become a global standard or just stay as a niche asset. How do you see personally the adoption of Bitcoin evolving over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years?
I do think that eventually everyone will own Bitcoin in some way, shape, or form. I hope that most people decide to learn a little bit about self-custody and hold it, you know, the actual spot Bitcoin in self-custody. But I do think that more and more people over the years will start investing in it, even passively through things like index funds that have exposure to Bitcoin companies, or through these ETF products. I just think that slowly but surely everyone will start to adopt Bitcoin. And sometimes we get ahead of ourselves and we want it to all happen now. We want it to happen overnight. But if you really zoom out, after I learned about the history of money, it made me appreciate how fast things are actually moving in Bitcoin, because the process of monetizing gold took thousands of years. And Bitcoin is moving faster than the speed of internet's adoption. So I think we've come a long way. We do still have a long way to go, and we really need to educate people, and we need to take things seriously when it comes to ensuring that our freedoms are protected, our property rights are protected, our privacy is protected. I think those are going to be some of the battles going forward. It's just how we're able to use Bitcoin. But I'm very hopeful. I mean, I really do think that this is a tool that the whole world will embrace, whether you're a CEO or among the poorest, whether you're in the developing world or in the West here, it's for everyone. So I do have a very positive outlook on where Bitcoin's going.
Appreciate that. And what do you think about other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum or Doge or Tsui, etc.? So I feel you focused mainly on Bitcoin, but do you have a personal opinion on the others?
I'm a very proud Bitcoin maximalist. I would call myself a non-toxic one. I don't care what's in your portfolio. You know, free markets, I think that everyone needs to invest based on their own level of risk and comfort and knowledge. I only see Bitcoin as a true monetary network, though. Sometimes I see other projects and it's not clear to me why there is a token or what problem they're actually solving. I think people also throw around the word blockchain as if they understand it, but blockchains are, they're rather inefficient when it comes to databases if you're really going to try to decentralize it. And that's what makes Bitcoin so special. There's a real reason why there's the energy component. There's a reason why it's so-called slow on the base layer. It's really so that it stands for the test of time as the most decentralized and most secure computing network. And that's what it has achieved. So I don't understand, the use cases for a lot of the other projects out there. And I do believe that things will be tokenized, like real world assets will be tokenized. But at the end of the day, when you think about where you want to put your money, where you see the most potential for your money to increase in value, but also what will last through the decades, through the challenges, through the financial crises, through the whims and fallibility of human beings. And Bitcoin is the only one that I see being resilient enough to withstand everything. I think that you can't necessarily trust companies, countries, governments, and Bitcoin's something that I do trust because it's backed by math and energy. So I wish people all the best with their investing. don't hold it against you, but the only thing I want to hold is Bitcoin.
Okay, clear. I follow also a Bitcoin pioneer, Raoul Paul. I'm sure you've heard of him.
Yes, he's been on my show.
He's been on your show. Okay, great. So he always repeats this mantra, like Bitcoin is a store of value. And this is true. Like it's like digital gold in a way. And I tend to agree. Now, however, one question, I mean, I used to work for Google in the past, and I know that last year, I think Google did big strides in the area of quantum computing. And I've read some news that says that this actually might present some threat to Bitcoin. What is your take on that?
I'm not worried about that, not at this time. We do know that computing is going to continue to advance, but the amount of qubits that they've been able to achieve in quantum is nowhere near the ability to hack SHA-256, which is the algorithm that secures Bitcoin. I've heard, some of the greatest names and voices in mind speak about this, and they're also not worried. And so it's just something that I think if and when it becomes a problem, then Bitcoin has some of the most brilliant minds in the space who will be able to confront this with a solution, whether that be, a quantum resistant algorithm that we upgrade to. But I think the most important thing to emphasize is that everything will be hacked before Bitcoin. So if we get into an era where quantum computing is really a threat, the things that we should be worried about are things like our bank accounts. It's funny because you mentioned Google, right? Google, why would Google release a form of quantum computing software that could hack their own servers and their own email platforms and their own, maybe they'll be issuing stable coins in the future. So maybe they'll be a financial platform as well. Like they're not going to do something that threatens their own business. So I think sometimes the threat of quantum is sort of overplayed and and people worry about it a little bit too much. I actually think that we will definitely be able to create solutions for that. And again, there are so many things that will be under threat before Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is so secure.
Okay. And when we talk about governmental oversight or let's say control, do you think Bitcoin will truly remain independent and has the ability to really remain independent in the long run?
I do. Yes, I do. Okay. I think that it has, it has already grown and diffused to such a position of strength and resiliency. It is incorruptible. I mean, it would take the equivalent of like two navies worth, I've heard, in order to just try to obtain as much energy as it would need to try to enter in a nefarious block for 10 minutes, and immediately the Bitcoin network would probably reject it. So it would be a complete waste of money, a complete waste of time. This isn't anything that one nation state or one rogue organization or rogue government agency can take down at this point. And we're so lucky that it grew organically. This is a very bottom-up phenomenon, grassroots, that it was released into the world to fail or to succeed, and it is succeeding by its own merit, by being adopted around the world. And it has amassed so much energy protecting it at this point that it would be very, very difficult and really arguably pointless to try to hack it. So the alternative is, how do you use it to your advantage, right? So I think that in the future, the game theory will be nation states trying to mine as much Bitcoin as they can, to buy as much Bitcoin as they can. And I think the challenge that will be in front of the public is making sure that we elect people who protect things like our privacy, our right to self-custody, our ability to sort of use this network in a way that empowers us and not in a way that infringes on any of our freedoms and rights. So that's where I think the battle will be. That's where I think countries will diverge from one another. Some will be more in favor of offering freedom to the individual, others will be against it. And we'll see how that plays out. But at the end of the day, I think that Bitcoin creates a new incentive system that rewards more accountability, more freedom, more responsibility. And so I think, and I expect people to kind of vote with their feet and go to places where they can use Bitcoin as freely as possible. And I've seen that already start to happen. You know, a lot of people within the Bitcoin space have already moved to places like El Salvador and Portugal and places that are saying, we embrace Bitcoin. We're not going to overtax you. We're not going to try to take away any of your rights. And so I do think and hope that America will make the right decisions on it. I guess we'll see. But this administration, I think, is going in the right direction. So we'll see after that.
I see. So you think that governments and major institutions will eventually integrate it rather than try to control it? This is kind of the scenario that you see most likely to play out, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And in the past 2 years, we've seen many large institutions and even governments now invest tremendously in Bitcoin, like BlackRock, right? Did a huge investment in Bitcoin. Yeah. El Salvador, that you just mentioned, I think, is probably the first state to invest such a large amount in Bitcoin. But you see it a bit, you see this move a bit slower in areas like Europe, for instance, where probably there's more regulation in the financial markets. Again, I'm not sure, but that's my guess, than those countries. So, like, you see that poorer countries are currently venturing into Bitcoin space, whereas more established, like secure countries are probably a little bit risk averse.
Yes, but I think that's to be expected. I think that the further away you are from the global money printer, which is essentially the Federal Reserve and our central banking system, I think you have more of an imperative to try something like Bitcoin in order to escape from some of the oppression that the financial system has placed on a lot of nations around the world. And so if you take the time to read about what the World Bank and IMF have really done to countries rich in resources that are now highly indebted, I do think that those are the first ones to adopt a lifeline like Bitcoin, whereas maybe the G7s, the more developed nations and economies, maybe the later ones to do it. Also because those economies tend to coordinate with one another a little bit more, right? I had Jeff Park on my show in recent months, and he brought up a really interesting point, which is that there is so much coordination when it comes to central banks, whether that's the European Central Bank working with the Fed or the Japanese Central Bank. I mean, there's so much talk between all of them. All of them are connected through these through this, you know, the SWIFT network and these swap lines that they open up for other countries. And so I think that a signpost would be that several of them actually adopt Bitcoin at the same time. It wouldn't just be kind of the United States coming out by itself, but sort of pivoting and more nations kind of recognizing that this is a legitimate asset. And we've already seen the move more towards neutral reserve assets in the last year, because right now gold is about to take the place of U.S. Treasuries as the number one reserve asset, which hasn't happened for many, many decades, right? Yeah, so we're almost like taking a step back because we took on a system that really was unsustainable since 1971, where we depegged from gold and we sort of lost our rails. We lost our tether to something that's real and that prevents us from just being able to print into oblivion. So I think that neutral reserve assets are going to increasingly be more valuable, and Bitcoin just has yet to be recognized by sort of the bigger, more influential nations and central banks.
Yes, I see. Natalie, I know you've got a new book coming out, Bitcoin is for Everyone, which you just mentioned earlier. So the title alone says a lot. What inspired you to write a book on Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I just really wanted an approachable 101 book. I think everyone has a voice. There are some fantastic Bitcoin books out there, and I have loved reading all of them. And I just kind of wanted to share my own take on what the problem is, how we got here, how the problem has manifested into so many symptoms that we see daily in our society, and why I believe the fix is Bitcoin, and really kind of breaking down how Bitcoin works. So I hope that it's a very approachable introduction to Bitcoin for people of all backgrounds, no matter where you are. We hope to translate it into as many languages as possible. And we just want it to be that very friendly 101 book that gives you an introduction to Bitcoin, but doesn't overwhelm you, because learning about Bitcoin can be a little bit, it can be heavy, right? It's like, yeah, wow, there's absolutely all this stuff about the financial system. I never learned this in school. It's sort of like unlearning while you're learning. So I just wanted to make it as gentle and positive as possible. It is politically neutral. It is uplifting. And I really want it to make the person who's reading it feel empowered, because so many things around us today make us feel like we're not smart enough, we're not good enough, we're not working hard enough. And this book actually tells you the opposite. It's telling you you are working hard enough, you are smart enough, and anyone can learn this and embrace it, and it's accessible to the whole world. So it's a very empowering book, and you can get it starting November 18th, but you can pre-order it now.
Great, and we'll add those links into the video description. But writing a book is different than hosting a podcast, right? So what is like the main difference that you see between both channels? Like on your podcast, you interview specialists, subject matter experts, and you also present your news digest as well. Is the book like more for beginners or okay?
The book is totally for beginners, and you actually, you're spot on about how different it is to write a book than the scripts that I've been used to writing. Because when you write for television or for a podcast, you write the way we speak, which tends to be a little bit more choppy, you know, incomplete sentences, and you can't write a book that way. So I'm so grateful that I actually had help along the way from an amazing collaborator by the name of Allison, and she worked with me on my writing a lot, because I tend to write for script style programs and not for the literary word. And she really helped me with that. And I'm so proud of this book. I mean, I worked on it for almost 2 years. It's been a long time coming. So I'm waiting for the actual physical copies to get here any day. And I'm excited to share it with the world.
Yeah, we're excited too. So looking forward to see that, to see the release of the book. Yeah, for sure. Now, if there's one myth about Bitcoin that you hope to put to rest with this book, what would it be?
The biggest is that people think they're too late And I really want this book to make them feel like they're actually very early, that this is one of the most empowering movements and that all of us can be a part of it. It's accessible to everyone. I really get sad when I hear people say, well, Bitcoin's over six figures and it's not for me anymore. And I want them to understand, you know, how small Bitcoin still is relative to all the asset classes and really all the wealth that's out there in the world in things like bonds and real estate and stocks. And we actually have a huge opportunity ahead of us. You know, Bitcoin's worth only about $2 trillion, whereas global wealth is somewhere between $900 trillion and $250 billion worth. A lot of that is denominated really in debt, right? It's in credit markets, it's in bonds, it's IOUs. A lot of it's in real estate and in stocks. And I think that Bitcoin will continue to eat into all of these different asset classes. And so if you think of $2 trillion in a $1 quadrillion, you know,
it's a drop in an ocean
of money. We have a long way to go, and that's a huge opportunity again for the average person. You can start small. You can start with a couple dollars and start dollar cost averaging and depositing every week or every month. So that's the biggest message for sure, is you're not too late.
Okay, great. It's reassuring. I think many people fall into the trap of thinking, wow, it's too late now. You know, let me try to find another cryptocurrency. And that's even more dangerous, right?
Right.
As you mentioned. I've also heard once Jack Mallers say that that Bitcoin is very different than other cryptocurrencies because it has this component of a proof of work. I don't know if you know more about that, or if you can expand on this idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important that Bitcoin has this tie to energy. And energy is something that none of us can print. No government can have a monopoly over energy and sort of print more Bitcoin or manipulate the network in any way. And that's really important, because the point that Jack actually makes, which is a brilliant one, is that if we trade our time, which is really our scarcest asset on this planet, for something that someone can just print out of thin air, then they can control us, right? And they control how much value that we have. And that's wrong. That's morally wrong. It's ethically wrong. And it disenfranchises so many people. And that's what we've seen. And that's what we've seen happen. And so we need something that is outside of that system, that no one can manipulate, no one can control, that is tethered to something that is true and measurable. And that is energy. So Bitcoin, the proof of work, these computers that are mining Bitcoin around the world, they're essentially taking part in what's a very sophisticated lottery. They are literally guessing numbers. And the proof is you expended the energy for the chance. Now, most computers, you know, they're not going to get that one block. They're not going to win, but they're still expending the energy. They're trying. And so I feel like that also reflects in our life. You know, like the more that we put into something, the more of our energy that we put into something, we see results and they compound. And I think it's important, because so much today, I think our value, the prices of things, they've been totally skewed and manipulated to the point that value no longer accrues to where it was actually created. Value accrues to whoever is closest to the money printer, and it's not fair. And so no wonder you have a whole huge amount of people, regardless of which team they decide to be on politically, that are just saying, this isn't fair. And I've worked hard and I've played by the rules and I can't get ahead anymore. So we need something that empowers them. And Bitcoin really gives you back your time. It's measured by something real. It's measured by something that none of us can control. And so the energy component is very strong, because once you remove the energy component, you have to introduce something else. And so this is what Lynn Alden has articulated beautifully in the other tokens, right? They're not proof of work. They're proof of stake largely. That means you introduce governance. You introduce a hierarchy where certain people benefit, certain people make decisions. If you have more to stake, you can earn and verify more. That replicates our current system. Our current fiat is really proof of stake. And Bitcoin is so beautifully different and outside of that system. So the proof of work aspect is really, really important.
Okay, so you're saying that by design, Bitcoin has this energy component. And if you also add to this probably the fact that there are only 21 million Bitcoin that will be ever mined, so the scarcity aspect as well, together these are a perfect antidote to inflation, right? This is kind of the key message here.
Yeah, there's no one who can manipulate or change the network's monetary policy, which is fixed, and that supply and that programmatic policy is etched into the code, and everyone can verify the code. It is open source for everyone, but no one can change it. It is resistant to any sort of manipulation or influence, which is really, really powerful. And Satoshi was brilliant in many ways because he was able to achieve through creating, proof of work and the difficulty adjustment and combining all of these cryptographic technologies in order to allow us to truly reach consensus in a decentralized way, in a way where you don't need trust and you can send value from one person to another and everyone can verify that that transaction took place in an honest way. And that is so different from our current system, right? Our current system is one where you have to have an intermediary, you have to get permission, you often have to wait. There are people, there are toll takers along the way that are all trying to get their slice. Bitcoin kind of, returns us to the most purest form of exchange. It is truly, what is the price and what is the supply, and you can make a fair trade. And I think that that's something that we haven't had in a very, very long time. And you've actually created the ability to essentially do the same thing as me exchanging with you cash, right? If I hand it to you, now you have it. It was a pure exchange, peer-to-peer. Now you can do it online in a way that's decentralized to 8 billion people, allowing them to interact with one another and create circular economies and exchange value with one another. I think it's absolutely just incredible. And, some people, when they're first learning about Bitcoin, they get the question of, well, what if I were to amass a tremendous amount of energy, right? I plug into a hydro dam, I suddenly have so much power and energy and I'm contributing it to the network and I could probably guess more. I can guess more, which means I can mine more Bitcoin. Well, there's Satoshi's difficulty adjustment, because the difficulty adjustment actually changes the difficulty of that number that they're all trying to guess, so that the more computers, the more hashing power, the more energy that's on the network trying to mine Bitcoin, the harder it is to solve it. And so it always self-regulates to those like 10-minute blocks approximately. And when a bunch of computers fall off the network and there's less mining activity, like we saw with the China mining ban in 2021, then it gets a little bit easier to solve. So the software actually self-regulates itself so that it's always those 10-minute increments, and so that that policy remains in place, whether there are a billion computers mining Bitcoin or just 10. I mean, it's incredible. Okay.
So you're saying that the platform and the software has already built in guardrails that prevent like abuses, etc. But question to you, is this software constantly being updated and upgraded by people, by developers?
There are people who are verifying the code. There are a lot of developers that are exclusively dedicated to looking at Bitcoin's code, but it is not being tampered with. And in fact, it's actually something that's very important to a lot of Bitcoiners, that people don't try to tinker with it too much, right? Changes can be proposed. They're known as BIPs, but it's very, very difficult for any of those changes to actually become code. Because as you could probably imagine, there are so many people, there's a lot at stake, right? A lot on the line.
For sure.
And so a lot of the changes that get proposed just get rejected or never even come into the conversation, because you don't want to introduce anything, even if it looks on the outside like it's going to help Bitcoin. You do not want it to have second or third or fourth order effects that change Bitcoin or open up to any threats of changing the inflation policy or ultimately the security of Bitcoin. So we had a massive what's called a block size war in about 2017, where some developers and some investors actually wanted to increase the block size so that they could facilitate more transactions with each block of 10 minutes. And it was actually rejected. So everyone can decide, if you run a node or if you're mining, you can decide to accept the changes or to just run Bitcoin as is. And okay. The community spoke for itself, and it actually did not upgrade to this change. It forked, and I believe it created Bitcoin Cash or one of the other tokens. And so that one, you could just tell if you look at the price, one succeeded, one failed. And so that's what's so beautiful as well. It's like a truly free market, and people vote with their nodes. And so if a change is proposed and people want to adopt it, they can, or they can reject it. And the true chain is the one that the most people adopt and run.
Okay. And do these developers, are these people on a certain payroll, or it's just like volunteerism? How does it work?
Yeah, there are organizations that fund developers. I'm not familiar with all the funding sources, but again, it's just, there are definitely people who are dedicated to looking at Bitcoin's code, looking for potential bugs or, incongruencies that might need to be addressed, looking at things like when will quantum be an issue. So there are people, but again, it's not something where you want to go in and tinker and change it, because the beauty of Bitcoin is that it's resilient to change.
I see. As we wrap up, I want to zoom out a little bit and beyond Bitcoin, understand a bit your work and how you see the world, really. So what freedom really means to you? When you say financial freedom, that's one aspect of freedom, but it probably stems from a bigger vision of or understanding of freedom.
Well, Bitcoin made me think a lot about time, kind of going back to what we discussed earlier about working so hard for a form of money that someone can just print out of thin air. There's a sense of injustice in that, right? There's a sense of someone has power over us without our consent. And so the thing about Bitcoin is it returns power to us. And the most powerful asset that any of us could have in addition to money is time, is the ability to make decisions for the future, to plan for the future. I think the reason that so many people feel a sense of frustration and angst today is because they're now in this short time frame where everything is like immediate and pressing, and there's like a deadline. They're living paycheck to paycheck. They don't know if they're going to survive the next month. They don't know how to plan for their future. They don't know if they can afford XYZ expense or their retirement or the college. It's always like this panic, and they can only think in the short term. And I think that changes how we behave, right? It changes whether we have hope in the future, and it changes how we act toward one another. Because if you're in a sense of panic, just trying to survive basically your day to day, your paycheck to paycheck, you're not going to be as cooperative, as thoughtful, as long-term thinking as someone who isn't in that state of panic. And so that's what the gift of Bitcoin is. It gives you your control and your power over your time again. It allows you to drop your time preference and think more about the future, because you know that you're going to be able to save for the future. You know that you're going to have some freedom and flexibility in order to take care of your family, your community. And I think that encourages cooperative and ethical and moral behavior much more than our current society, which is really just, it's placed everyone on this treadmill that's running faster and faster and faster, and people are just trying to catch up. So that's what I think is like truly, freedom is this sense of someone has allowed you to regain your time and your control over your life. And I think for so many people, they don't feel that. Even if they're working really, really hard, even if they have a stable, 9 to 5, they don't feel like they're in control. And they don't feel like if they stopped doing that, that things would be okay. So Bitcoin changes that, I think. And we haven't had a society that judges itself by how well it saves in a long time. We judge ourselves by how much we spend, how far we go into debt. And I think that we need to change those metrics. So that's why Bitcoin gives me a lot of hope, because I think it gives more people the freedom and ability to really plan and innovate and take care of the people in their lives into the future.
And hence the importance of education, because as you said, not everybody understands that, it's all about actually being financially secure and saving versus spending. And this is why you're into the education business, I guess, right?
Yes. I still think we have just so so far to go. And a lot of people think they understand, but the reason I know that they don't is A, they're not investing in Bitcoin, but they're also just, they're pulling apart into these political teams and they're completely identifying themselves as one party or another. And they're getting wrapped up in things that are only symptoms. They're only symptoms of the true cause and the true problem. So I think that once they're empowered with the knowledge of what the problem really is and what the solution is, they can start to move into the zone that I think a lot of us Bitcoiners are in, which is the solutions focused zone, one that does have hope for the future, does look at the future positively, is trying to contribute and grow and all of that. So that's what I hope for people. I hope that they feel as empowered through Bitcoin knowledge as I have.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, Natalie, where can people know more about your work and your upcoming projects and your book?
Yeah, so you can listen to my show Coin Stories on all podcasting platforms. It's on video, so on YouTube, Rumble, as well as on all the podcast platforms. My book is Bitcoin is for Everyone. That's coming out in November, but you can pre-order it now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore really. And then you can reach out to me on my social platforms. On X, I'm at Nat Brunel, and on Instagram, I'm at Natalie Brunel. And beware of impersonators. Look for the blue check.
Yes, always. Natalie, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show. I love how you bring both clarity and simplicity to such a complex topic as Bitcoin.
Thank you.
And I think our listeners will really connect with this. So everyone, be sure to follow Coin Stories and keep an eye out for Natalie's new book, Bitcoin is for Everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Natalie.